Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and I'm delighted to welcome Pasha Madavi, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, to discuss his new book, Power Grab, Political Survival Through Extractive Resource Nationalization, published by Cambridge University Press in April 2020. Welcome, Pasha.
Thank you very much for having me.
So your book argues that leaders nationalize extractive resources to extend the duration of their power by taking control of the means of production and establishing state-owned enterprises. These leaders, you say, capture revenues that might otherwise flow to private firms, and they use them to increase capital to secure political support. It's a fascinating book. It has many cases that are both very familiar to us and also not familiar to us. It's clear, although it also has a lot of quantitative data and charts, but you make it, you bring all of it together beautifully. Before we start talking about the argument, I noticed that your interest in the politics of energy and extractive resources actually goes back to your childhood and your uncle's metals trading company. So I was wondering if you'd start us off by just telling us a little bit about how you came to be interested in this subject and how you came to write this first book of yours.
Well, absolutely. And thank you so much for the kind words about the book and for that really fantastic introduction. It's interesting. I put this in the acknowledgments part, and it really does go back to my time as a young boy. I had these two very different experiences from two different sets of uncles, really, on different sides of my family. My father's brother was a metals trader in Iran, and now he's living in the UK, and had his oil and metals trading firm assets nationalized in Central Asia. He was working a lot in Tajikistan in particular. And he received his compensation only like cents on the dollar for what his assets were worth. And it was quite a shock to see that happen to somebody, especially as a young child. You don't know this idea of government being able to take something from you. The other two uncles were from my mother's side, and they were pioneers in solar thermal technology for home water heating in Europe. And, they were trained in Iran. That's where my family's from. And made me aware of a lot of the, obvious, fantastic benefits of renewable energy and the promise of solar technology in particular, as well as some of the weaknesses of the industry, namely that the materials needed to make sustainable solar energy still had to be mined from a finite source. And so, those two different experiences got me on track of thinking about energy from a political perspective. And, the more you dive in, you see, understand how vast the energy market is in terms of its potential for learning, as well as how nuanced the role of politics is. So this book really came out of that line of thinking about these extractive resources as instruments of political control. To use a great phrase from Johannes Erpelinen and Vichian. And it has continued to pique my interest ever since I was a young boy.
Let's catch the listeners up on some of your basic terms. When you talk about extractive resources, you're talking about petroleum and minerals, metals, other precious commodities. Can you catch us up on what extractive resource nationalization means? It's a mouthful, but
it
actually, but each word means something. And I found your definitions really compelling, and they helped me through the rest of the argument. So let's start there.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for that. I mean, it starts with, thinking about extractive resources as different from other natural resources. This is not about agricultural commodities. Sometimes there are instances where they resemble or mimic a lot of the political economy patterns of extractives. But when we think about this term, it's referring to, as you said, the book is largely about oil, for example, natural gas, coal, metals and minerals, some of which are kind of essential for clean energy's transition, the transition to clean energy. So palladium and cobalt and lithium and these kinds of things. So those are all kind of the idea of an extractive resource as compared to, say, you know, tomatoes and grain or fisheries, right? So that's kind of the point with that term.
So it's sorry to interrupt you. So it's the finite amount that's there that distinguishes it from something like agriculture that we assume is renewable?
That's right. I mean, it's an interesting kind of distinction in a way. You know, part of it is the term extractive itself, why we have to literally take it from out of the ground, underneath the ground, you know, coal, for example, metals, we'd have to mine them from ore, petroleum, getting it out of reservoirs. So there's a extraction component to it. But I also, you know, when you think about the boundaries between these goods as compared to agriculture, there is this finite element to it, and that it is not renewable the same way agriculture is in its own right renewable. So exactly that. But the nationalization component of it, that, you know, again, it is a mouthful. And trust me, I've tried to come up with different ways to shorten the phrase, but it does it less justice. And so the nationalization component of it, for me, looks specifically at the state taking control of operating those natural resources, those extractive resources. And it's about having control over operations in the hands of the government rather than private companies. And sometimes that happens by force. You know, there's a forced takeover of a series of companies' assets. This is kind of the classic case that people talk about with oil nationalization in Mexico in 1938. It was a forced acquisition of Standard Oil in, you know, exchange for some, you know, very small amounts of compensation compared to the value of the asset. But others are not so forced. You know, others are building a state-owned enterprise from the ground up and having the state manage those resources on behalf of the government, or having those entities manage those resources on behalf of the government. And funny enough, a classic example of that is the USSR, you know, the framework set up by the Soviets for how they pretty much ran the rest of their economy. Now, of course, there was some taking over to be done, but it was certainly different from the takeover of multinational corporations that we like to think of in terms of nationalization. And those are kind of some extreme ends of what I consider to be called in the book operational nationalization.
And you note that 90% of oil, 94% of gas are state-owned. So can you start us off also by letting us understand just how extensive state ownership of extractive resource extractive resources are? I knew I would do this, and I hope you wouldn't, but there it is. Maybe it doesn't want to be done.
No problem. Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable to think that every single oil producer in the world has at one point nationalized their industry except the United States. Now, I mean, every single major oil producer, I mean, there's certainly small ones, but the United States is an exception. Everybody else at one point in time has nationalized and created a national oil company. Our neighbors to the north, for example, in Canada, had created what was called Petro-Canada, nationalized in 1976. Now it's privatized, you know, less than 15 years later. And same with the British and the French and the Italians, who all had national oil companies of some kind. But even today with those privatizations, it's still controlled in terms of the amount of reserves that are existing in the world, still vastly under the control of national oil companies. And kind of the ones that we tend to see in the news really are the big players. Saudi Aramco, which is Saudi Arabia's national oil company. Saudi Arabia had nationalized along with so many else in the 70s. The Russian oil companies, Rosneft in particular, as well as their natural gas company, Gazprom, controls certainly a lot of resources and oil reserves. The Iranians, the National Iranian Oil Company, and the Venezuelans, PDVSA, are just some of the top kind of big major players that control assets of oil and gas under the aegis of a state-owned enterprise. And so it's very rare to find places that don't have oil controlled by the state.
As I was reading this book, and I am a political theorist, I thought a lot about Machiavelli. Mm. You seemed to be emphasizing this distinction between how we seize power and how we maintain power. And your book is really about how resources help leaders maintain their power. And you describe this choice as to whether to nationalize or not as a form of political gamble that you might nationalize and but risk future prosperity. You might maintain private operations and secure a long-term sort of financial stream. So it's a choice. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on these choices and how they and how the leaders make them.
So, I mean, that's great that you have Machiavelli in mind, because I think that is, you know, at the heart of all of this, which is the political calculus involved with nationalization. And it's something that we've taken for granted in the literature, because so much of the work that had been done prior to political scientists entering the scene was solely about economics. And so I've built off of some of the great work by Pauline Jones and Erica Weinthal, who've thought about nationalization and kind of seizing control as a political decision and one made with political goals in mind. And so, you know, my book is ultimately a book about opportunistic behavior by leaders and how that extends their rule and power. You know, the gamble that exists is a gamble because nationalization is quite risky. The trade-off really is that if you nationalize, you can get a lot of money now and a lot of revenues for the state now, but you're doing it at the expense of future money because of future inefficiencies of national oil companies and nationalization, as well as some of the consequences of nationalization in the form of loss of investment in the future, as well as the more direct risky natures of retaliation. Which is why there's a certain element of risk even in the beginning. But if you don't do it, it's also considered a bit of a gamble because you're giving up on money that's being taken out of your country effectively. This is why extractive resources have this very interesting element that so much of the extraction and operations are managed, in particular in oil, by foreign companies, multinational companies like Exxon and Shell and BP, that if you don't nationalize, you're letting them take bigger pieces of the pie. And so there's a kind of a gamble on both sides. And, you know, that's where this opportunism and the decision to be aggressive is itself, you know, a part of the decision to take on this risk and take on this gamble. I have this, you know, paradox that I set up in the book in a way that, you know, you have this instance, or you have these weaker leaders, those who don't think they're going to be around for a very long time. And so they have much more to lose in terms of not being able to get money right now. And so they have less to lose in the future. So they go on and typically nationalize, thinking that who cares about future money? I need money right now. They ultimately get stronger by doing this, whereas the stronger leaders opt against nationalization, but lose their grip on power because they have this lost opportunity effectively for revenues, as I mentioned before, that are being captured by multinational corporations and the like.
Pasha, give us an example of each of those. I think it'll help. Your examples in the book are terrific. I mean, the book opens with sort of setting the stage of, you know, why did Gaddafi do this and Chavez do that? And it really helps remind me of how much I actually know about this, but I would never use these words. So can you give an example of the two ways to, you know, sort of pull in maybe what people already don't know they know about this?
Absolutely. You know, I love that you raised this because I love talking about my cases. And in fact, the case that opens the book, as you mentioned, is Gaddafi and Libya. Back when Gaddafi was just a young man who took over from a monarchy that didn't think it was going to crumble. You know, this happened in 1969. Gaddafi was only 27. And deposed a monarch by the name of King Idris, who, when he was in power, had opted not to nationalize. Idris had allowed American and European oil firms to operate Libya's oil assets and reserves. At the time, Libya had been the fifth largest oil producing country in the world. This was quite, you know, front and center in the oil world when Gaddafi comes in. All of a sudden, Gaddafi reverses course and starts nationalizing and seizing control of those oil companies, and in particular, starting with British Petroleum, or BP, and forms a national oil company known as Linoco, Libya's national oil company. And that's an interesting case where you have the same structure, the same, you know, geological structure, the same oil fields, but two very different leaders with two very different mindsets. You know, ironically, you had Idris, who thought he was going to be in power for such a long time and thought he had complete control over the country. And indeed, his elite did, you know, have complete control over the economy. It didn't nationalize because, again, that gamble, he didn't want to give up on future revenues as well as future investment. And then you have Gaddafi, who, once he comes in, is facing coup attempt after, you know, coup attempt. Doesn't think he's going to be, you know, around to see the end of the year, let alone the, you know, nearly 40 years of rule, had it not been for foreign invasion. The other cases, though, that really underpin the book go towards kind of the Middle East, away from North Africa, but in particular the cases of Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, which, as you mentioned, a lot of people probably know a lot more about this than they think they do, because, you know, a lot of these cases were huge in terms of international policy implications. Iran, for instance, and I talk about multiple cases of nationalization there, but the one that many remember is Mohammad Mossadegh, 1951, who nationalized British Petroleum again. They're at the losing end of this in a lot of places. And, you know, why I bring this up and why so many people know about it is because the British, in retaliating against Mossadegh, recruited the help of the United States. And this was kind of the United States' first real foray into Iran and into the Middle East. You know, 1951 and 1953, Mossadegh was deposed in a coup, basically an infamous coup for many Iranians who saw him as a democratically elected leader, even though there was a Shah and a king. But it was a key turning point, not only for Iran, because it didn't nationalize again until 73, and a lot of people were turned off to nationalization, but also for the United States, which became a more active player in the Middle East after that. The Saudis, meanwhile, at that time in 51, had the choice to nationalize. This is King Ibn Saud, kind of the one that we look back on as kind of the father of this current dynasty, whose, you know, descendant Mohammed bin Salman is kind of the crown prince right now, obviously in the news a lot. Ibn Saud did not want to nationalize. And, you know, in these same discussions that he was having with oil producers, he saw a lot of the grievances that the Iranians saw, but also, again, was forward-thinking, didn't want to lose the future revenue streams, and because of the strength of his monarchy and his ability to see a long time horizon. This is building a bit on the great work of Michael Herb, who's written a fantastic book about the dynastic monarchy in the Persian Gulf and beyond. But that's an interesting kind of comparison point that I talk about in chapter four of the book. The Iranians versus the Saudis in the 40s and early 50s kind of gives a bit more insight into that era, especially thinking about Iran as really, you know, a first mover in a sense in the Middle East that later led to some restraint on the part of many who saw what happened to Mossadegh after 53.
You brought up a lot of literatures, and that's actually one of the strengths of the book, that on the one hand, you're talking about resource extraction and pushing us to think about the politics and not just the economics. You're operating from multiple political science and economics literatures, and you're very careful to trace your roots, which I always appreciate in a book. It's always nice to know where certain ideas came from and how you're pushing them, altering them, and rejecting them. So maybe it's a good moment to talk about the method. I mean, there's in-country studies, there's long, sort of over time studies, and there's also cross-national statistical analysis. Explain a little bit about these methods, whether you do field work, and also what's novel about your approach to statistical analysis.
Well, thanks for that question as well. I mean, it is a broad range of approaches that I try to use with this, because there's so many different aspects of this, as well as so many different ways to bring evidence to light that support the argument. And I've been trained in multiple different methods going back to my time as an undergrad and even a master's student before I do my PhD. And so, you know, a lot of it, you know, rests on, you know, one of the chapters, as you mentioned, is a cross-national and longitudinal data set that is analyzed using kind of a broad set of statistical analysis, and that might be common to many readers. Others are looking at within country analysis of Iran, in particular in chapter 6, where I developed a new method to try to better understand the counterfactual for Iran. And here, the key point was to try to grapple with what Iran's revenue stream would have looked like had it not nationalized again in 73. That's kind of the heart of that chapter. And that took a couple different methods to really understand and kind of answer a lot of questions I had about, you know, what the consequences of nationalization were, as well as why the Shah did it when he did. So I blended archival work that I had done both at the BP archives in the UK, as well as the British archives and the US Library of Congress and the Foreign Relations of the United States archival work, as well as work that I'd done in the past in the field in Iran back in the early 2000s to show or to kind of paint a picture of why the Shah felt the need to go this route and nationalize, as well as to construct this viable counterfactual for what Iran's revenue stream would have looked like had it not nationalized. Right. And I did that using data from the archives, from BP's archives, to construct projected revenue streams and compare them with what Iran actually made at the monthly level, and having to check through a lot of the statistical assumptions that are required for doing that kind of analysis, which the archives allowed me to do. These were actual conversations between the Shah and the CEOs of the oil companies being nationalized, documented and declassified only recently.
Sorry to interrupt you, Pasha. What's those kind of archive moments, especially when you're going through materials that have not been seen by many other researchers because they're recently released. What was a kind of big aha, oh my goodness, moment for you in the archive? Was there something where your just eyes popped?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a great question, because you know, you're sitting there in the archives, you know, hour after hour, day after day, pouring over, you know, conversations, documents, letters. For me, there were a couple. You know, one of them was this big moment of seeing the Shah, in his own words, talk exactly about the diffusion element that was central to one part of the argument about how information spreads and how governments break this gap between firms and governments in terms of money, in terms of revenue. And here you have quotes from the Shah himself complaining about the deals that the Saudis and Iraqis got. He's yelling at the oil executives effectively, or I can see it. I can see him yelling through the pages of doing so. And the other is kind of the discussions that the oil producers themselves were having in private, and you know, that they were saying, he's not going to do it. He's not going to nationalize. He can't do it. He doesn't have the capacity to do it. You know, why would he go this route? You know, he's making these crazy claims. It's all written, all out there, you know, in the archive text about all of the fascinating dynamics at play between, you know, this at the time, very aggressive monarch and a set of oil executives who really thought they were in good shape and they could placate his demands. And the second was the coming across the revenue data, which was something I didn't know that I would find, And there are two sources that I was able to unlock in when I was at the archives that showed these projections and showed a lot of the assumptions behind them and how BP came up with these projections. And I was like, oh, wow, that is one of a kind, as well as exactly what we need. That's the kind of counterfactual we have to construct in order to identify the effect of nationalization on revenue that the Shah was actually taking in his pocket. But that's, you know, that chapter has this blend of those two methods. The statistical method, which is a difference analysis for those listening out there that are more statistically minded, with the process tracing that I try to do based on the archival discussion of why the Shah ended up doing this, as well as other reasons for Iran's grievances against the companies. But an earlier chapter that talks about that I mentioned between the Saudi and the Iranian 1940s and early 50s debate about whether or not to nationalize also has a case comparison that I talked about a bit before, as well as a different method that some political scientists use called Bayesian statistical analysis. And with that method, what I did is I combined the cross-national data with interviews from oil experts to construct what are called priors, which are basically our expectations, our prior givings about what we would see in the data, combining that with the data themselves. And so kind of merging interviews with the cross-national data to try to unpack the determinants of oil nationalization. And that's the fourth chapter of the book that gets at that question. The fifth one, I'll just say briefly, talks, again, with the more classical and conventional methods that we use on cross-national data, looks at the consequences and how leaders end up surviving longer, those who ended up nationalizing compared to those who didn't. And that looks at a couple of different steps in the process. Again, the nationalization giving you more money. So indeed, we see that happening, not just in Iran, but across the oil producing world. It's a data set of effectively 175 countries over 110 years, varying levels of oil amount. I know 60 of them are major oil producers. But as well as looking at the survival rates of leaders who undertake these gambles. And it turns out that indeed those who don't nationalize are less likely to survive than those who do nationalize. So in those three chapters really make up the heart of the book, the empirical heart of the book, that tests the argument that the first two chapters set up. And they do so using a range of different methods that reflect my own training, both as a political scientist and a statistician, trained in grad school, as well as an undergraduate where I had studied economics and energy economics in particular.
I had a question, and first of all, I guess I want to say that one of the strengths of the book is that, full disclosure, I can't follow the differences in the statistical methods, but I can follow the argument really well, and I can understand how you're using it. And so, that's a hard thing to do as somebody who's using sophisticated quantitative data to make sure that all readers can get to your main claims and understand how you're presenting the evidence. It's very impressive. I mean, this is not a lightly researched book.
And thank you.
And the combination of qualitative and quantitative and the ways you bring out the strengths in both sorts of techniques is what I think good political science should be. But that's editorializing.
thank you.
Let me ask you a question about state ownership. You make a distinction in the book between state ownership with and without control as a kind of de jure de facto distinction. Mm. I found that part of the book fascinating, and I'm wondering if you'd just explain a little bit about these two different types of nationalization.
So that's a great question as well. And thanks for your comments about the book and the ability to merge in multiple methods with the argument. When it comes to the state ownership issue of how to measure it and how to think about it, I've built on a lot of the pioneering work done by Erica Weinthal and Pauline Jones, whose work I mentioned before in their book, Oil is Not a Curse. That's the title of their book from 2010. And they talk about this distinction about control versus not having control. And I took it a step further to talk about where that's happening in practice, rather than just based on the laws set in the country's constitutions or petroleum laws. Because often the case is that countries may legally have the right to operate oil fields, but they don't actually do it. This came out of work that I had followed back when I was a master's student, started by a guy named David Victor, who'd worked on a book called Oil and Governance with Mark Thurber and David Holtz on national oil companies around the world. And I was a part of that volume and looking at the types of different ownership structures of these companies, and some who had legal ownership, again, legally nationalized the oil industry, but weren't actually producing any oil. A classic example of this is Nigeria. You know, Nigeria nationalized in 1971 and created a national oil company known as the Nigerian National Petroleum Company, NNPC. They don't actually operate as an operator. They are more of a manager. They work through partnerships and production sharing agreements with kind of the Shells of the world and the Chevrons of the world. And they have a number of smaller subsidiaries that are engaged in a lot of, you know, downstream activities. And what that means is stuff like distributing oil, refining it, and selling the gasoline. But when it comes to actually extracting and operating, they don't do it, even though they have the right to do it, the legal right to do so. And it's a technical issue because they can't do it, but also there are political considerations as well that go into the book. But the other side of that are countries like Angola, who, you know, initially wanted to take that outright control and couldn't. You know, they started in 1976, and 2 years later, they took that control, both de jure and de facto. They were able to build the technical capacity to actually produce the oil. And so, you know, there the conversation, really the distinction is, are you physically producing or not? Because if you're not, then you're still missing out on a lot of the revenues that are being captured by the multinationals. And you still have a lot of the issues, the problems that governments face when they deal with these firms, which is namely a gap in information on things like profits and costs and amount that's produced, because the government just can't know the specifics as well as the person who's operating it. And so not having the actual physical control over production makes it very difficult to narrow that gap. And so that's kind of the key distinction of what, you know, what I'm thinking of in terms of operational nationalization, as I call it, as a term kind of goes out throughout the book.
No, thanks. That's so helpful. Another topic that you bring up that I think also I found fascinating was this idea of political resources as a curse, once you have them, so you're holding on to the bauxite that everybody needs for their batteries, but that will only bring corruption and conflict and loss of personal freedoms and the crumbling of the rule of law. I'm wondering, in any of the cases that you looked at, whether there are liberal democratic outcomes, liberal or democratic and or from extractive resource nationalization.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is another great question about one of the literatures that the book really builds on, and this idea of a resource curse, which was, you know, first kind of coined in political science by Terry Lynn Carl with this book called The Paradox of Plenty, and then by Michael Ross, who's my advisor in graduate school, and a big piece called Does Oil Hinder Democracy? And later became a book in 2012. But this issue of democratic kind of outcomes and good governance outcomes really was a topic for debate among many who were studying the resource curse and yet saw a lot of positive cases, places like Norway, you know, places like Brazil, that were, again, big oil producers, and also for my case, nationalized their oil industry, and yet were able to kind of maintain thriving democracies, as well as many of the others that I had pointed out before that had nationalized in the past that are, you know, oil producers. Canada, the United States in particular, are major oil producers and yet don't have the curse. And same with the UK. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of what many call the conditional resource curse, that you can be cursed conditional on other factors. It's a great book by Thad Dunning called Crude Democracy, which goes into issues of income inequality and kind of explaining why the curse wasn't so prevalent in Latin America as it was elsewhere. Another one is Ben Smith's fantastic book called Hard Times in the Lands of Plenty. And that's a book about Iran and Indonesia, where Smith really dives into some of the conditions that are needed to allow for, you know, a curse at one time and not a curse at another. And those books set the foundation for another book by a guy named Victor Minaldo called The Institution's Curse. That's another book in my series, the series on business public policy at Cambridge. And Victor gets into issues of the institutions that were around at the time of nationalization, and in particular, I'm sorry, at the time of natural resource extraction, that led many to actually become not only democratic, but thriving democracies, like North American cases, like the UK, as well as some interesting cases in South America and kind of beyond. And my book kind of builds on that to say, you know, this story of the curse is also a story about nationalization, which many others have said, but haven't really tested clearly and haven't really understood the mechanisms that underpin that connection between national oil companies and the resource curse, as it were. And so what I find, as I've mentioned before, is that these long-serving autocrats that we typically associate with the curse, you know, Gaddafi, you know, Saddam Hussein, the Shah of Iran for a time, the Saudis, and so on, are doing so because they're able to capture the revenues that were otherwise forfeited to multinationals. And they couldn't have done that without nationalization. And that's why you see the failure of a lot of leaders in places that are still oil rich, that present a puzzle for resource curse scholars. But that my book kind of points out that, look, they weren't able to capture those revenues. They weren't able to take advantage of their wealth because so much of it was taken out of the country. And so it unpacks more of the curse states, but also adds to the discussion of, you know, why we see the curse in some places and not others.
No, that's fascinating. So I have a last question, which is this not linear from what you were just discussing, but it jumped out at me. You write early in the book that leaders are prompted to update her beliefs about the problem of survival. And I found this completely jarring because the cases that you interrogate throughout the book generally are about male leaders engaging in these power struggles with mostly male actors. And I couldn't tell if it was a sort of simple attempt to be gender inclusive or really whether there was something coming in the book that maybe I missed about gender. And I'm wondering if women are involved and how is resource nationalization either affect them because they're the leaders negotiating these political gambits or because of the resources that are doled out from those gambits?
That's a great question. It's one I haven't gotten before, and it's a very astute observation. And in fact, the answer is that I had a leader in mind, which was Cristina Kirchner, Argentina's president, who had nationalized in 2012, you know, back when I was first kind of writing that part of the book, especially the early part and thinking about the theory. After Kirchner nationalized in 2012, it was quite a failure for the Argentine government because they ultimately had to repay the firm they nationalized, Repsol, to the tune of $5 billion. This is part of the problem of nationalization, why it's so much of a gamble, the retaliation component. And now, you know, private oil companies, multinationals like Chevron and Shell are producing much of Argentina's oil, in particular shale, in the Vaca Muerta fields. And so, yeah, the gender question is a great one because it's not only interesting that at the time you had a woman president nationalizing kind of in one of our more recent oil nationalizations, but also hints at the male dominance of the oil world, as well as the oil economies in places that are big producers of oil. so that gets into one of the ironies of this, because you have a woman president nationalizing kind of one of our most recent oil nationalizations, but speaks to kind of the male dominance of the oil sector and the male dominance of the economies of the oil producing country, so much so countries, so much so that there's an entire section of the resource curse literature that looks at the gender dynamics and the gender inequalities that oil and extractive resource wealth brings. Indeed, many of the players that are involved in a lot of these nationalizations are men, and that is a consequence, in fact, not a coincidence of oil wealth. But fascinating that you have, especially in the 2010s, cases of women presidents in particular at the stage, center stage of nationalization, Cristina Kirchner, and then of course the big scandal of the national oil companies in Brazil with Dilma Rousseff, Brazil's former president.
So before we say goodbye, tell me what you're doing as your next project.
So there, I have a couple of projects, actually a lot of projects, too many to really manage in the midst of the book coming out and everything else that's going on. But I have a project coming out just in a few weeks after this podcast on the unintended consequences of natural gas flaring policies, and looking at kind of the climate impacts of policies that are designed to mitigate climate change. And this refers to specifically shutting down the burning of natural gas at oil wells. It's called flaring. And we have this article coming out in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences, PNAS, about the unintended consequences of those policies, as well as an exciting new project that we're working on now on the decarbonization strategies of oil and gas firms, and in particular, the multinational companies' efforts, or really, I should say, non-efforts at promoting clean energy transition. And that actually ties with some of the parts of the last chapter in the book, which we haven't talked about a little bit yet, which is the connection with clean energy and the connection with climate change, because of the resources that are kind of the drivers for clean energy projects like renewables, such as solar and wind, are extractive resources that could be nationalized and really could throw a wrench in the supply chains, not only of the solar and wind plants, but also batteries and storage capacity that allow renewables to compete so effectively against fossil fuels. And so we've got this study that looks at the firms themselves and the kinds of strategies that they pursue, and ultimately have found that while they've made a lot of political noise about being cleaner and being greener on the business side, they haven't done much. And lastly, I'll say there's a great new project that I'm really excited about, working on cash transfers and looking at the politics of giving people money. And some of this is based on natural resources, because I got interested in the Alaskan case, as well as the economies of many of the countries that we've been talking about so far, like Iran and Saudi Arabia, that use their oil money to give people things effectively. And one of the things that they give people is money. We are thinking now about policies like the universal basic income and other instances in which governments will be paying people instead of people paying governments in the form of taxes. And so it's a project that looks at the consequences of that and how that alters individuals' behaviors when it comes to political engagement and civic participation.
Well, thanks so much, Pasha. I think everyone who's listened can tell that this is a complex book written by a very generous author, somebody who is always signaling the work that he depended upon, learned from, and improved upon. The book is Power Grab: Political Survival Through Extractive Resource Nationalization by Pasha Madavi. It's from Cambridge University Press. It's out just in April, and it's available from the Cambridge University website. It's available on Bookshop, on IndieBook. It's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I would direct you to a brick and mortar, but none of us are going to those stores. However, Many of us know that there are local bookstores that are mailing things for free. Here in New Jersey, it's Labyrinth Books, and they'll mail anywhere in the United States, right across the street from Princeton. So please support your local bookstores, and please take a look at this book. Pasha, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun. And I just want to encourage folks again to purchase from the brick and mortars. And I want to give a plug for my local bookstore back where I grew up in San Diego called Warwick's. And they're online. You can purchase from them online and they'll deliver it to your door anywhere in the U.S. But thanks again, Susan. I had a great time. And thanks for your fantastic questions.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for joining me.